Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. We have an early start tonight because we have three speakers, and I think some of our audience isn't here, and one of our speakers isn't here, so we'll see how we go. We'll just roll along and see how we go. Prue Goward's missing and Anne's gone looking for her, so there you are. So it's great to have Doug Kersner and Tony Moore here, and in anticipation, Prue Goward. Doug and I last had a conversation at Melbourne University, I think in 1968, and we resumed it today at lunch. Haven't seen Doug for four decades, but so it's great to have him at the Sydney Institute, but we have been in contact. Now, Doug Kersner is a professor of philosophy and psychoanalytical studies at Deakin University. He's a published author, and he's commented on the ABC for quite some time. Tony Moore, of course, is now the New South Wales History Fellow. He's just submitted his PhD. He's a published author. He worked for 9 years at the ABC and was on the ABC Advisory Council. Welcome, Prue. And oh, no, she's on time. That's okay. And Prue Goward, I haven't checked with her what I should say, but I guess her background is a journalist, a prominent ABC presenter. She was, of course, the Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner, and in recent times, the Liberal MP for Goulburn. So thanks for coming, Prue. And everyone's here and we're on time, so I haven't discussed the order with Prue, but I thought we'd start off with Doug. Then I think we'll go to Prue, and then we'll go to Tony Moore. So we'll just run the three, and then we'll come to questions discussion, and everyone's going to speak for about 15 minutes, and we'll finish the whole gig no later than 7 o'clock. So Douglas, welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jared, and thank you very much for inviting me, and even just for the stunning view over here. It's fantastic. And it is great to be here to see you again, to have discussions directly with you face-to-face after 40 years, because we actually got on very well at Melbourne University, despite the fact that we were, I think, presidents of rather different political clubs. I was the president of the Labor Club, and Jared was the president of the DLP Club at that time. So I think, Jared, you might remember that we even ran on a unity ticket for the Union Council.
We did run on a unity ticket for the Union Council and lost.
Yeah, we did. We did. It was not a good political decision, apparently. So, to the ABC. There can be little doubt that things have improved at the ABC since the appointment of Mark Scott as managing director and the appointment of Maurice Newman as chairman. A new broom has swept aside some of the egregiously obvious problems of bias, and a more professional approach has supervened. There have been new programs that increase debate, including the ill-fated experimental difference of opinion, which is to be replaced with a new Q&A program that's based on the lively and controversial BBC program Question Time. Media Watch is not as politically partisan to one side of politics now. Paul Chadwick has been appointed as Director of Editorial Policies to try and ensure that the ABC fulfills its statutory obligations under the ABC Act to be accurate and impartial. In terms of balance and fair-mindedness, Middle East correspondents Matt Brown and David Hardacre are marked improvements over the days of Tim Palmer and Peter Cave. For anybody who believes that the taxpayer-funded broadcaster needs to be impartial and accurate, balanced and fair, this is all to the good. Now, the two major issues, I think, for the ABC that I'm going to be talking about, and I think they really are major issues, are those of bias and of genuine diversity. The culture of the ABC is clearly left of centre. Bias has not been so much party political as cultural. It is often not deliberate, but bespeaks taken for granted assumptions, mindsets that are far from the concerns of the mainstream Australia that pays for the ABC and which, in return, the ABC is supposed to serve and be fair to in its range and its content. It is not the job of the taxpayer-funded national broadcaster to act as a counterweight to other media or mainstream ideologies perceived to be too right-wing by a staff whose centre of gravity is way to the left. Why is it that the only intentionally liberal or conservative program on Radio National is called Counterpoint? It is a counterpoint to a way of thinking that dominates the culture of the ABC in the taken-for-granted assumptions of the mentalities of the people like us who broadcast to other people like us. I think these recent observations by British journalist Nick Cohen, he wrote this book last year called What's Left, and Nick Cohen wrote about how things have changed in British cultural institutions is relevant to the ABC. And Nick Cohen says, a contact at the BBC says that when the workers were the repository of radical liberal hopes in the 60s, his predecessors encouraged working class writers and directors. Now, women and members of ethnic minorities have unparalleled opportunities, and that is a welcome advance. But the beneficiaries of the new order are always from the upper middle class. In the name of diversity, Cohen says, everyone is the same. High cultural institutions that once dreamt of a proletarian uprising now treat the white working class as racists or squares. As Michael Collins, a rare example of a working class intellectual, put it in his book The Likes of Us, the vision of a multicultural utopia needed its common enemy, and it was increasingly the tribe that played a major role in previous utopian fantasies, he said. Now, in 1968, about the time that Gerard and I last met in face-to-face, in 1968, German student leader Rudi Dutschke, do you remember him? Rudi Dutschke, drawing upon the idea of hegemony of Marxist political theorist Antonio Gramsci and also of Marxist critical theory, suggested what he termed a long march through the institutions. He suggested a long march through the institutions of power to create radical change from within government and society by becoming an integral part of it. As the critical theorist Herbert Marcuse put it, working against the established institutions while working in them. The countercultural capture of cultural institutions meant the emergence of what Swinburne University sociologist Catherine Betts has termed a new class, whose object, the object of this new class, was not old wealth, but instead, Betts writes, the attack was concentrated on the Australian mass and its materialism, racism, sexism and insularity, she said in The Great Divide. Now, this noticeably homogeneous class of inner-city, tertiary-educated social professionals, often referred to as the chattering classes, has an identity that developed together with mass tertiary education. While the old left emphasised economic reforms to help the working class. The new class focused on issues such as refugees, multiculturalism, reconciliation, civil liberties, etc. This new class of social professionals includes teachers, academics, public servants and welfare workers who adopt distinct ideological positions and values that serve as social markers for the new class. The knowledge class, which includes ABC journalists, is an important segment within the new educated class who have more distinct values that increasingly set them apart from business and from the general community. I mention this not because I think that the ABC has no diversity at all, but because it's a trend embedded within the institutional culture that will take another long march to reverse, this time in the opposite direction towards the centre, I hope. It's a march that has begun from the top, but needs to infuse its way to the bottom. A recent Four Corners program, Dangerous Ground, broadcast just this, on March the 10th, just 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, illustrates some of these issues. The program began with problems about setting up an Islamic school in Camden. Those against a Muslim school being set up are described in primarily racist terms. In the next suburb, according to the Four Corners blurb, Aussie-born sons of Middle East bitterly complain of being treated like enemies in their own country. Now some community leaders, the program blurb continues, are warning of a nasty backlash due to the hostility that young men like these feel is aimed against them. The program is concerned that counter-terrorism and security could actually be increasing the threat of breeding homegrown terrorists. Erring on the side of aggression just to be on the safe side can radicalise and alienate the people who are targeted, analysts tell Four Corners. An expert suggests that radicalisation occurs because of, quote, young people feeling under siege from police and the wider public. His fear is this could morph into an agenda for violent change, Four Corners asserts. And finally, Four Corners suggests defeating terrorism presents not just a policing issue, but also a challenge to core community values of pluralism and tolerance, end of quote. No mention of Sheikh Halali and those more extreme than him, or the impact of Muslim fundamentalism and propaganda, or the role played by police and security forces in protecting us from Muslim extremism. The only actors of any consequence for Four Corners are those who buy the narrative that the causes of Muslim extremism lie in the West. It is a problem of criminality, it's a problem of law enforcement, of poverty and racist behaviour towards suspects of Middle Eastern appearance. Of course, there are legitimate issues here that we need to debate, or should be debated. But I'm pointing to the one-sided narrative that suffuses this program and others, which does not take Islamic extremism seriously in its own right, but mainly as due to its exacerbation by us. Or consider what amounted to a campaign for David Hicks by ABC Online. Now, the ABC isn't unique here. Consider the following comments about the BBC, and this was a statement by Andrew Marr, who's a political pundit in Britain and a BBC political editor between 2000 and 2005 in the Daily Mail, in 2006. The BBC is not impartial or neutral. It's publicly funded. It's a publicly funded urban organisation with an abnormally large number of young people, ethnic minorities and gay people. It has a liberal bias, not so much a party political bias. It is better expressed as a cultural liberal bias, he said. Or a statement by Jeff Randall, who was a former BBC business editor in The Observer in 2006. He said, "It's not a conspiracy, it's visceral. They think they are on the middle ground." Randall further commented on this in The Guardian a year later, in September 2007. "I think there's a streak of hypocrisy at the BBC," he said. "I said it when I was there. Its definition of impartiality or the middle ground is not how many of us see it. That's why I'm contemptuous. There is a liberal consensus. The BBC denies this, but Andy Marr," who I quoted before, "who most people think is part of that liberal consensus, came out and said it. So it's not just right of centre people. When you're there, you can feel it, you can smell it, you can almost touch it," he said. In June 2007, a report commissioned by the BBC concluded that it failed to promote proper debate on major political issues, particularly single-issue causes such as climate change and poverty, because of its staff's inherent liberal culture. The report concludes that they should be more willing to challenge their beliefs, concluding, "There is a tendency to groupthink, with too many staff inhabiting a shared space and comfort zone," it said. Executives admitted at a 2006 staff impartiality seminar that, quote, "they would broadcast images of the Bible being thrown away, but not the Quran, in case Muslims were offended." It's from the BBC report, reported in the Telegraph. The former New Statesman editor, John Lloyd, observed, "The reflexes of the BBC and of most broadcasters are culturally and politically on the liberal left, reflecting the leanings of the humanities-educated intelligentsia in most states. One could easily, as I'm suggesting, substitute ABC for BBC in all this. It all goes to the issue of culture." That the Labour Party and the Liberal Party receive similar treatment on the ABC only demonstrates that there may not be cultural bias towards one mainstream party rather than the other. It is true that the ABC has criticised both sides over the years, but that may be because they are cultural liberals who are to the left of both the major parties in the direction of the Greens. The ALP has been victim to the ABC while in government, as Gerard would well remember. During the first Gulf War in 1991, the ABC employed Dr. Robert Springborg, who was then an associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Macquarie, as its expert commentator on the program, The Gulf Report. In an article in the Melbourne Sun, Springborg had equated the modes of government of Saddam Hussein and Bob Hawke. "Hawke's decision to send ships to the Gulf was," Springborg said, "every bit as much of a one-man show as is the country we may be fighting," end of quote. It was Gerard who blew the whistle on the fact that Springborg was scarcely impartial. Hawke himself went further, denouncing the ABC's coverage of the Gulf War as, to quote Hawke, "loaded, biased and disgraceful." 11 years of the Howard government, basically bipartisan Senate estimates critiques and an ABC board comprising conservative and centrist members has made some difference to all this. The much mooted number of ideologically conservative members of the board has not translated into a conservative agenda for the ABC, nor has it impacted on the visceral culture of many among the staff. But the board and the Senate estimates hearings have made for more accountability for the public corporation to adhere to its charter and be more fair and balanced and not advocate for politically correct causes. Though these necessary changes have had to come from the top leadership down, so entrenched has the institutional culture been. However, I'm pleased to note that the culture does not dominate all parts of the ABC by any means. In news and current affairs, for example, PM is fair, balanced, impartial and very professional. I think Late Line casts a wide net and is generally fair and balanced, as is the world today. The ABC should not advocate causes left, right or politically correct, but should be a repository for a genuine diversity of views in addition to being accurate and impartial. If the ABC board takes action on these issues, it's not interfering with the ABC, but doing its job as required by the ABC Act on behalf of the taxpayers of Australia. Almost every organisation is run by a board that leads and oversees the activities of that organisation. At least in the world as we know it, they are not run by workers' collectives. The ABC Act obliges the ABC, and I'm quoting the ABC Act, to broadcast programs that contribute to a sense of national identity and inform and entertain and reflect the cultural diversity of the Australian community. The ABC Board has a vital statutory role here. The ABC Act says it is the duty of the Board to ensure that the gathering and presentation by the corporation of news and information is accurate and impartial according to the recognised standards of objective journalism. Genuine diversity at the ABC, reflecting a wide range of views and subject matter in line with the diversity of the Australian population, together with making certain that high journalistic standards are kept to, are tasks that the ABC board has a clear duty to perform effectively. As Tony Wedgwood Benn, remember him? He was the British Labour Minister of Technology, and he put it in 1969. Broadcasting is too important to be left to the broadcasters. I think there has been more recognition of problems and potential problems in relation to political bias and culture and the genuine diversity at the ABC recently, and that the chairman and managing director deserve to be commended on progress in a positive direction. But the root cause lies in the culture, and I'm afraid that the reverse long march through the institution still has a long way to go. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Gerard, and it's very nice to be back at the Institute. Well, I think we should all agree, for starters, that the ABC is left-wing. I worked there for 19 years, and it was very difficult to find people who were not Labour supporters, unless they were Greens or Democrats. The heavy unionisation of the ABC probably accounted for much of this, but not at all. Not all of it, of course, by any means. People are entitled to their values and their views, and like recruits like. Reporters are human. When they are pricked, they too bleed. They too have beliefs and are entitled to those beliefs. Much of this is entirely defensible. The exception is the last bit, which is like recruiting like. I don't think that is defensible. People need to be recruited on merit, not on political values. Of course, there are honourable exceptions to this, like Gerard Henderson, who is seen as to the right of the ABC Centre, and even myself. In political circles, I know that whenever the ABC is accused of bias, it replies that it can't possibly be because it employed both Gerard Henderson and Prue Goward. Now, that we are seen as to the right of the ABC Centre tells you a bit about where the centre is. But you could never say that Gerard Henderson and Prue Goward balance out the rest. There are obviously, however, other ABC reporters who work very hard at not being biased, some in this room, and even among those with known ALP allegiances. But I fear to name them, maybe to condemn them to being tagged as fellow Conservatives, so I will not. It's also true that the ABC's blogs promote the views of people like David Barnett, my husband, also seen as being on the right. Sometimes I agree. But blogs aren't mainstream, at least not yet. But why is it that the direction of lean is almost always to the left and not to the right, Labour not Liberal. This is not true in many regional newspapers, magazines or parts of the commercial radio and television world of reporting, but it is true of the ABC. I've tried to answer this question many times. I used to think it was a reporter's idealism that drove it, but it is a long time since Labour stood for idealism. Perhaps it is peer pressure of the so-called intellectual elites or the socio-economic backgrounds of reporters. Perhaps it is about the reporter's tribal character. Reporters, you see, were the tribe of bright, cheeky kids who sat at the back of the class, who underperformed but had a lot of fun. And the SWAT sat down the front, entered the professions and became liberals. It was a sort of tribal war. Now, I used to think about that a lot. And today I don't think it's worth thinking about. Don't think it's worth understanding. I do think, however, in an era of blogs, Wikipedia, and the many other sources of untested information now available to the public, that the importance of the ABC being above all that, being a believable news service, has never been greater. Well, almost everyone I know who takes the world seriously listens and watches the ABC. Almost every one of those also hates the ABC. Now, this tells you something about the people I know. It tells you several things other than that they are irrational. Andrew Peacock used to say, when he was opposition leader, that he listened to AM while he was working out on his exercise bike. He was said to be the fittest man in Parliament House. And as he got angrier and angrier, he got faster and fitter. So these ABC customers that I know are intelligent. They take the world seriously, they are well educated, and they do rely on the ABC for news and analysis of news and current affairs. Yes, they might also watch their documentaries, their police shows and their period costume dramas, but that is not at issue here. I often find myself saying to them that if they don't like the ABC, they should watch commercial television or listen to one of the many commercial radio stations. And sadly, my advice is usually rejected, along with a crack about my unfair, unworthy and cheap debating point. In other words, their rejection of commercial television has nothing to do with commercials, which in a grotesque sort of way most people find interesting, although perhaps not the number of them. In fact, SBS's commercials are actually quite nicely done at the top end of advertising. I think we'll agree that the production values of commercials are greater than ABC or SB television shows, so perhaps that's not surprising. No, the rejection of commercial radio and television by these serious, well-educated people, who, as I say, take a deep interest in the world, is based on the content. Content not just being the selection of stories that the ABC believes to be relevant and its persistent pursuit of them, whether or not the public is, but also in the way they construct each story. The ABC has, by default, become the entertainment channel for the elites. And the elites are comprised of both left and right, progressive, conservative, radical and conventional, scientists, poets, artists, managing directors, accountants and university lecturers. Unlike the commercial channels, which need to make money, the ABC does not need to entertain mass demographics. These are well catered for, with money provided by consumers through advertising instead of taxes. Without being told to, the ABC has evolved to being the network for those who want more than mass entertainment, but who are not sufficient in number to support a commercial network of their own. The ABC is also required to play a role in promoting Australian culture, interests and ideas, again, more an issue with these audiences. And I think we have to agree this would have to be the most critical and difficult, although loyal, audience of all to please. The absence of clear measurables, such as advertising revenue as an indicator of success, or of relevant measurables, such as audience share, has no relevance to such a small market. Bedevils debate about the adequacy and the achievements of the ABC. There is nothing as simple as ABC about the ABC. So we should acknowledge that the ABC has a tough job pleasing its audience. Most of the ABC's homegrown non-news and current affairs content is uncontroversial. Antique shows, gardening shows, children's shows, rural lifestyle shows, book shows and interview programmes. ABC comedy is particularly successful, innovative and, when it can be adapted to mass audience tastes, is commercially successful. Of course, once the masses find out that Kath and Kim are laughing at them, that might come back to the ABC. The ABC's dalliance with Australian drama is a bit more of a hit and miss affair. Sea Change being a hit, and East of Everything, I suspect, about to become a miss. Sea Change being sharp comedy, drama, it's dramatic, it's snappy, and it's conventional. East being untidy, visually ugly, with scenes shot in vans and run-down houses. East is actually all the things Australians never admit to hating about Australian movies, but which explains why so few Australians actually watch them. There's a link, I suspect, between ABC Australian drama productions and its news and current affairs, the latter, of course, being the target of almost all resentment of the ABC, and where all the demands for reform are actually focused. That link between the ABC's unpopular dramas, Australian dramas, and its unpopular current affairs is the attempt to be different, without quite enough skill to be brilliant. If you're poor, then really the only way to get noticed is by being different, experimental, counter-conventional. And sometimes that experiment comes off. The punk, who wears the outrageous torn dress with the nappy pins in it, which becomes a designer dress worn by Liz Hurley. Now that is the ABC's challenge, and also the Australian film industry's problem. No money. Think ugly Australian movies like Mullock, soliloquies in lavatories and dead exchanges between shabby and unlikely people and asbestos huts. Think Australian drama on the ABC. Meanwhile, the mass audience demographics hate all of that and don't apologise for not watching movies or TV dramas that look like that. They don't feel any nationalistic commitment to watching Australian drama if they don't understand it and if it isn't pleasurable. But the elite, like the rich, are different. We like complexity and ambiguity. We even like what we don't enjoy. We want to be challenged, intimidated, mystified, intrigued, informed, angered. And we want to believe in Australian culture because we either run it or we have a direct stake in it. So when it comes to homegrown ABC drama, don't be surprised if it is often a dud. With a population of 20 million, it is not possible to churn out the quality of drama produced by, say, the BBC or the US television channels without their enormous budgets, well beyond the scope of a state-owned television enterprise. The BBC, it must be noted, has invested heavily in quality production and does extremely well out of programme sales. SBS has used its advertising revenue to good effect also. So long as the ABC and its friends refuse to accept advertising revenue, and the government of the day goes along with them, then the capacity of the ABC to produce high-quality drama with attractive people, great scripts, and high production values is inevitably limited. Remember, the US may have 20 scriptwriters working on a show, a half-hour show, where the ABC may have two. The number and complexity of shots used, the lighting and so on, are all production values which are compromised by lack of funds. So in opposing commercial revenues for the ABC, we need to accept the result, that it is a risk. Some of its productions will be good, maybe excellent, and many others will just be poor. That risks will be risky and not come off, that experiments will fail. If it makes you angry watching an impenetrable and ugly ABC drama, as the one who is closest to me on the couch is often angry and grumbles about his taxes at work, remember that this is a choice we have made. In a sense, the role of ABC News and Current Affairs has also evolved to be different, provocative and counter-conventional. That guarantees it will be controversial and as likely to be wrong as right. It is certainly likely to offend people, all of whom write letters and complain much more than those who were not offended or who thought it was okay. So if the role of the ABC is to feed the elites with their news and current affairs diet, amongst other entertainment, then how well is the ABC doing it, and does it need reform? Or is this an inevitable result in a small market with an even smaller elite audience? Let's focus, I think, on news and current affairs because that's where the fight really is. And let's start with staff selection, like recruiting like. Within the business world, diversity is recognised as a high-performance tool. Yet again, the reliance on the public purse has historically enabled the ABC to avoid the inclusion of this fundamental principle in its recruitment and professional development. Unless you restrict diversity to meaning diversity by gender, disability and race alone, in which case the ABC works very hard at diversity. In fact, it should also mean diversity by class, all classes, probably religions, and certainly social attitudes. Opening up the ABC to advertising might change that, but it's no panacea. In any case, there should be no connection between the private values and views of ABC reporters and their output. Now I'm getting to the bit. The stories they choose to report as news, the talent they interview, the questions they ask, the grabs they run, the cutaway shots they use, all should not reflect the personal views of the reporter. Reporters are supposed to leave their personal views at home when they come to work. That they frequently and manifestly do not leave them at home is the issue. We should be trying to guess the political and social values of reporters without success, not instead to know them with some confidence. It seems to me entirely reasonable to expect objectivity from reporters. That is what they should be trained to do, to keep themselves out of the story, recognise their own biases and leave them at home. They must be hungry to know and report all sides of an argument, explore and test the facts. Sadly, unless objectivity in the institution's news-gathering culture is fiercely guarded, it will, in fact, attract people very unsuited to objective reporting. That is, advocates who see reporting news and current affairs as a means of reporting their own views. Articulate, adversarial and committed advocates whose verbal showmanship and derring-do not only enable them to shine, but also makes the work of the objective reporter look, in contrast, much less exciting and interesting. And I've certainly seen a lot of those reporters just fall by the wayside at the ABC. Not interesting enough. While commercial reporters might have to meet entertainment standards or sell ratings, that is not the obligation of the taxpayer-funded reporter. Of course, the ABC's report must be watchable and listenable, but it can afford to also be objective. Intuitively, the ABC audience understands this, which is why its elite members, left and right, expect more from the ABC than its commercial competitors. And at times of crisis, or when a really big story breaks, like a tsunami or a terrorist attack, the ABC's audience share leaps, demonstrating that the general public also believes the ABC to be objective and informed. As a one-time lecturer in broadcast journalism at Canberra University, I can say that objectivity is extremely hard to teach. It is difficult for the human brain to introspectively take an objective position on itself. This is the journalist's equivalent of a conflict of interest, but unlike the commercial conflict of interest, no one need ever know what values and loyalties and prejudices we hold inside, not even ourselves. But I would say introspectivity is only one part of the problem. More significant, objectivity is extremely difficult to teach and to adhere to when the student lacks sufficient knowledge or analytical tools. Yet this is precisely the position of the journalist in almost every story they report. They are a generalist, jack of all trades, master of none. They know very little about almost everything. Yet the big issues of today require very detailed knowledge. Reporting on a terrorist cell, the latest report on climate change, or a debate about constitutional reform or interest rate movements all require the journalist to be well informed. They need also to understand the technical use of particular words and to be able to manage statistics and facts and understand economic theory, historical theory, political theory. Now, not only do we live in a postmodern reality where your facts are not necessarily my facts, and both are equally valid, we also live in a world where journalists are trained to be journalists now and not analysts. It is possible to become a finance reporter without ever having studied a graph at university, because journalism teaching does not provide it. Journalism graduates, who today make up the bulk of reporters, may go through 3 years of an undergraduate degree and learn no science, statistics or maths, no history, no economics, no sociology, no government or politics. And I know that because I taught it. More importantly, in not studying a body of knowledge and in not acquiring intellectual and analytical tools, they also do not learn what they don't know. Very important to know what you don't know. Instead, they learn the craft of telling a story efficiently and identifying points of audience interest or relevance. They learn how to present conflict in a story, but they do not learn how to test facts, relying instead on other parties in the story to perform this task. Many times they do not know who to believe and either report, claim and counterclaim as equally valid or disturbingly will favour the claim of a party they believe to be the more trustworthy and ignore counterclaims altogether. The basis of their trust may be valid, or it might reflect their own prejudices. But frequently the reporter is unaware of the basis for their judgment. For reporters, that might mean preferring the word of an NGO to a government official, which was once my sorry duty. And that is despite the fact that the government official in question could have been sacked for providing the minister and the journalist with inaccurate information. Reporters might prefer the word of an environmentalist to a business representative because, as I was once told by a producer, the environmentalist is altruistic and therefore more likely to be honest. Can we expect anything more from a 20-something gun reporter with a microphone and no background knowledge in the subjects they are reporting on? And that goes for the selection of stories as well as their construction. As a friend of mine, who was then very senior in the ALP, observed, as he was driving home from Sydney to Canberra one night, he kept listening to news on the ABC and wondering what planet they were on, he said. It bore no relevance to the voters he knew and to the voters he wanted to vote Labour at the next election. Only on the ABC could we expect to find lengthy debate about Kevin Rudd in the United Nations or ongoing debate about the Children Overboard affair, and I say that for good or ill. This is not to say that ABC journalists cannot learn on the job and absorb a body of knowledge and intellectual analytical tools, and because they are curious, confident people, some do, but many, of course, do not. And when they have, they are poached by companies and politicians keen to use those skills and experience and that knowledge. The development of journalism degrees and the industry's reliance upon them has, in this era of fast-moving news gathering, put the ABC journalist at a distinct intellectual disadvantage. It needs to be said that serious newspapers, such as the Financial Review and the Australian, do recruit subject experts, as do parts of the ABC, for example, Dr. Norman Swan. But overwhelmingly, broadcast news and current affairs does not and cannot because its subject material is so broad. And we all know what happens when people are required to deal with information they don't understand. They are susceptible to misinformation and to their own prejudices and character. It is in the character of the reporter to love a drama, for example. So inevitably, distressing or alarming predictions and statements are preferred to more mild-mannered ones. So if I were to reform ABC News and current affairs, I would strongly discourage the recruitment of journalism graduates who did not also have strong analytical and information backgrounds. In fact, I once established a postgraduate journalism diploma for graduates at Canberra University, which I believed would provide the industry with informed reporters, but unfortunately that course is no more. The popularity of news radio suggests that there's certainly an appetite for mild-mannered, colourless but factual news information. The employment of journalists with science, history or economics backgrounds might also encourage the reporting of more policy and less politics. Politics is very easy for reporters. A leadership challenge, an opinion poll, election date guessing, it's all very inexact, all based on gossip and background information and supposition. Gaffes and stumbles, no matter how essentially irrelevant to the government of the country, or for that matter of the state, are easier to report than policy developments for reporters with little time and little background. But even with this reform, it is inevitable that most reporters will be ignorant, and I include myself in that. I had a background in economics and even some university exposure to the sciences, but certainly no great body of knowledge or analytical understanding of government. Which leaves us again with institutional culture and the importance of news directors, sub-editors and producers respecting the rules of fact-finding and factual reporting. They need to drive this culture of respect through the newsrooms, editing suites and production meetings. Not out of fear of the government of the day, not because it's the safe or the easy thing to do, or even because ratings are important, but because the journalist, the reporter, must revere fact. It is the foundation of news reporting. The ABC reporter must worship fact, and on this reverence is built the trust of a nation. The reporter must be sceptical at all times and of all quarters. The conscience of journalists must not be ruled by the expectations of their peers, or worse, by moral assumptions, but instead by the importance of accuracy and a genuine interest in matters affecting the lives of their fellow citizens, not themselves. Perhaps the ABC should remind its reporters that their job is in fact a simple one, to record and test the facts. They are not historians. They are not scientists. They are not even required to consider the public interest, although that might be considered consistent with news judgment. They are not, much as they might like to be, law reformers, advocates or players in public affairs. They are privileged bystanders with front row seats at the world's great events, and all they need do to keep their place is provide accurate accounts of that witness. It is for others, those academics, researchers, public servants, and even NGOs with their specialist knowledge and skills, to perform those other tasks. This, of course, has never stopped newspaper proprietors, especially from seeing the role of their papers differently. But we are concerned here not with those newspapers, but with a publicly funded organisation, and in finding a broadly acceptable role for it in an inevitably contentious industry, the ideas industry. The ABC must recognise and celebrate that its strongest news brand is not its righteousness, but its rightness, its correctness, not its political correctness. Informed and informing, evidence and not belief-driven. The elites, if we could stop bickering between ourselves, should be extremely grateful if that were all there was to ABC News and current affairs. Accuracy would be quite enough. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. Now, I'm a lefty who also has problems with lack of diversity in the ABC. I guess it's been a personal frustration of mine since working there for 9 years. I left in 1997, but in the period since, that the ABC friends or the defenders of the ABC have focused on funding and the bullying by the Howard government, and I'm not saying that they haven't been problems, and not looked at more fundamental reform of the ABC and where we would like the ABC, and we as Australians, I mean, would like the ABC to be in the next 40 years. What will it change into? Because it will not always be the mid-20th century broadcaster that we grew up with and love. So I want to put on my, not that I was invited, but a sort of 2020 Ideas Summit hat and look into the future, but with time permitting also drill down into drama, because like Prue, I also hate East of Everything or Wherever or whatever. It's an essential reaction to hippiedom wherever I see it, but we might get onto that as well. Now, the ABC is grappling with how to transform itself from a paternalistic public broadcaster catering to a loyal, if passive, audience to a multi-channel narrowcaster engaging diverse and conditional audiences that have an expectation that they'll participate or at least be consulted in content creation. Now, these are people, I would say, currently under 50, certainly under 30. And I know if I want to punish my son, I've learned I can't say you won't watch television. It's no, you're not allowed to use the internet. He had a few years' grace while I worked that one out. Now, while many innovators within the ABC are rising to this challenge, the wider public debate has been a sterile contest between those neoliberals who loathe the state broadcaster, which they imagine to be a nest of radicals, and those social democrats and old-style conservatives who uncritically love an auntie that is no more. Unfortunately, opposition to the Howard government's funding cuts, bullying of staff and stacking of the board have led to a negative siege mentality that stops people who value the ABC from doing the hard thinking about how public broadcasting needs to change to remain relevant to emerging audiences with different and in many ways more exacting expectations of media. Now, I'd like to just drill down, if I can, to what I see as longer-term cultural structural problems. And these began when I was there in the Hill and Brian Johns days. Internal accounting and management structures that have centralised control of TV content in the hands of a few senior executives, where it has seriously eroded program maker professional autonomy of the sort that existed in the 70s and 80s. So bring on the Workers' Collective, I never saw it. It was TV, very senior TV executives began entering the edit room around 1993, 94, 95. Two, homogenous a view of Australian culture imposed through centralised commissioning. Insufficient consultation with audiences about programming, signified by an over-reliance and inappropriate reliance on commercial ratings, and inadequate participation of the community in ABC corporate decision-making. The outsourcing of production, which I actually support in the non-news current affairs area, lacks transparency and suffers from the same problems of value for taxpayer money that plagues many other public-private partnerships, particularly in this fair state of New South Wales. Creeping internal commercialisation by ABC Commercial. Now, I've been a private sector publisher for the last decade. I have nothing against commerce, but actually, as a publisher, get miffed at the ABC giving a big hand up to its own publishing house, an unfair competitive edge. You know, this half-pregnant thing doesn't work for me. I know it raises money for them, and if we've got time, I'll answer some questions about the whole idea of ABC Commercial. And I don't understand how it escaped Senate Estimates Committee, but it seems to. A colonial cringe in favour of all things British on ABC TV that has led to far too many imports dominating prime time and insufficient attention to innovative programs made elsewhere, such as HBO in the United States. Even if many staff are fashionably Republican, the ABC remains the great defender of British culture in Australia and persists in maintaining a colonial deference to the BBC as the benchmark for quality. Most important, an aversion to risk, either aesthetic or intellectual, most apparent in the paucity of documentary and drama. However, brave commissioning of innovative comedy, I would argue, continues to buck this trend. But finally, a problem that has occurred over the last 10 years, the shrinking of a sense of national vision and ambition at the ABC, exemplified in the decline on our screens of flagship national projects. Now, many of the ABC structural problems stem from the cult of managerialism. This is a kind of public privatisation that combines internal market forces with cost savings and top-down control that gives all power to risk-averse bean counters that I've called moguls in cardigans. This system threw up an ex-accountant to be managing director of our premier cultural institution. Now, I agree that Mark Scott is a vast improvement on either Jonathan Shire or Russell Balding, and I think he's going in the right direction with narrowcasting, and I'll get up to that. But the layers of management bureaucracy and its remuneration increased at the ABC while creative craftspeople were shed over the last decade. Now, this is at the time that successful private corporations have flattened their management and given greater autonomy to team-based production. Now, those corporations, Microsoft is one of them, aren't workers' collectives. They're just harnessing the talent of the team and doing away with all those levels of red tape. Now, the report of the Australian National Audit Office, Corporate Governance in the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, prepared under Shire's regime, identified a problem of managers working up to the apex of the corporate pyramid rather than down to stakeholders. Translated to TV, shows are green-lighted because the director of TV likes them. And you can ask any ABC program maker or senior executive and you'll hear that, rather than in reference to audiences or charter obligations. Oh, if I could publish like that. We don't, in the commercial sector, can't say, oh, I don't like that book. You look at if there's an audience or a market for the book. Pretty logical. In David Hill's ABC, in the non-news current affairs area where I work, department heads controlled their own budgets and slots, granting a degree of diversity of taste. ABC Radio, while not immune to managerialism, I imagine is exempt from the worst excesses because of the hands-on and immediate nature of its medium. Now, as someone on the left, involved with the Fabian Society, my view is that progressives should ask what reforms enhance democratic governance, audience participation, diversity of content and creativity. First up, the talent in the ABC needs to be trusted to make professional judgments and to take risks. A more imaginative board would flatten the management, lose the consultants and reinvest in programs. Mark Scott plans to save money through automation of studios, replacing camera operators and editors. But it is in the bureaucracy that the real fat we could say fat cats, can be found to trim. The commissioning and budget power currently wielded by the Director of Television needs to be dispersed down by returning to the old system where the department heads and commissioning editors control content. And executive producers, if they take a salary, are to be trusted with editorial authority over their units, with decisions to be reviewed annually. This will restore some creative friction, which is lacking at the moment. The challenge for us today is rethinking the public sector from the midst of the information revolution. Media is moving beyond the crude dichotomy between the old elite public broadcasting and commercial broadcasting that appeals to the lowest common denominator. Channel 9's on the way out. Commercial TV, which coerces a certain majority of people to sell advertising to, in my opinion, and there's data to back this up, in the industry journals, is moving on. Subscription TV delivered digitally will be what we're looking at in the next 10 to 20, 30 years. Many people already have subscription TV. And statistics show young people are watching less and less TV. They're turning to blogs, DVDs, downloading films to watch in their own time. They don't want to be coerced into an audience by what they share and what they have in common. Now, this is all right. I do think there'll always be place things such as the news where people come together. But the challenge is to cater for the diversity that has always existed in our community. The beauty of the internet is that it caters for people's passionate interests. And I don't mean pornography by that. I mean hobbies, those things that we love. I'm a fan of Roman history. So is my son. We can do it all over the internet. It's not dumbed down. The ABC does this on a good day. It does it on a lot of Radio National programs. The Religion Report is full of muscular information on that topic. Gardening Australia does it, The Collectors. But I think you'll agree, Catalyst is a pretty dumb show. And that's my son finds, he's 12 now, so he said it's too babyish for him. These are programs of an old style that are trying to find what everyone has in common. Now, luckily, the charter supports diversity. Part 6.1a commits the ABC to broadcast programs that contribute to a sense of national identity and inform and entertain and reflect the cultural diversity of the Australian community. Now, perceptions of what constitutes quality is where program makers like me used to come a cropper at the ABC, because in a community as diverse as ours, both in politics, interests, class, ethnicity, religion, geography, we aren't all going to agree on what's quality. I had the experience of making a documentary called Bohemian Rhapsody, Rebels in Australian Culture, and the various intellectuals and crazy artists that were in that program were just deemed unacceptable by a particular executive at the ABC. And it was really weird. I'd earlier successfully participated in a program at Four Corners where we got Gerard Henderson to come in and be our reporter. So I thought anything goes. But Jared McKenzie, Walk was, and Barry DeVola were less acceptable, one being too much of a, I think the quote from the executive was a postmodernist, and the other was too camp. So my experience within the ABC, I guess despite all the huff and puff about the ABC's left-wing bias, was that having only two wings, right and left, as represented by Labor and the Coalition, is a pretty narrow debate. There's a lot more perspectives out there. When I was at the ABC, a left-liberal, harbour-hugging, tertiary-educated attitude to social issues certainly prevailed. But it was alongside a pro-market bias in economics. At least that's what I experienced. Everyone was all the way with Keating's agenda at the time, and we were quite excited by it, actually, and a rather old-fashioned Bush and Kokoda nationalism. But as a young ABC doco maker then, this worldview struck me as pretty conventional, conservative, soft, middle-brow, and incurious. It still does. I wanted programming that was more risky, dangerous, intellectually challenging, and experimental, or iconoclastic at least, rather than reverential of TV rules, that dared to be offensive. Now, I don't accept that when TV does that, it needs to be inaccessible. Some of Frontline, I think, was a perfect example of a program, or Blue Murder, programs that were playing with the form, that were immensely popular. And the ABC does it on a good day. But more often, the story is one of senior managers spending a great deal of money blanding out programs to appeal to what they imagine to be a core audience. I'd like to say that the story of a particular pilot being recut 50 times is apocryphal because it's a round number, but it was pretty close to that. I won't name the show or the executive. This is sometimes referred to in ratings jargon, this idea of the core audience, as the A's and B's. But I was told on starting in documentaries, mate, we make programs for Pymble. Apologies to anyone from Pymble. A decade later, Mike Carlton was told something similar when he started radio, that he had to imagine his listener as a neighbour in Epping. This is perhaps what John Howard had in mind when he described the ABC as our enemies talking to our friends. Now, I suspect program makers are projecting their own tastes, prejudices and background onto the potential audiences. Now, Courtney Gibson is, you may know, was head of arts and entertainment, and is now, she's got a superstar title. She is a rare iconoclast amongst commissioners, and she recently criticised the ABC as, too, quote, too white, too straight, too middle class. If you don't have diversity in the production offices, you're never going to get it on screen. When I'm surrounded by too many white middle class people like me, I can feel so blinkered I lose the will to live. Now, I know Courtney, and I know that she doesn't mean a politically correct Mandarin slice of the world. I actually mean a mandarin slice, like the orange-like fruit, which is that old politically correct women, disabled. She doesn't mean that. She is into aesthetic risk. She's very much of the punk generation in that sense. Speaking for myself, the ABC needs to better harvest the risky and original stuff that emerges from outside the official TV culture and that the ABC's managerialism usually filters out. Now, I'll just mention a few of the things that Doug also mentioned in the area of ethnicity. Because of the existence of SBS, the ABC has never really come to terms with its charter responsibility to reflect Australia's ethnic diversity. Now, I don't mean the leaders of ethnic communities talking about ethnic issues. I mean their role as Australians getting up to all sorts of very interesting things. Non-Anglos still appear on ABC TV as well-meaning tokens, loudly justified by an ethnic plot development rather than as a natural part of the Australian mix. Anglo-Celtic inner-urban program makers present ethnic difference as an unusual disruption to the Anglo mainstream rather than what it is, a major narrative of contemporary Australia that, in a sense, we need to be proud of. We, as Mary Kalantzis reminds us, the largest immigration program per capita outside of Israel and the most diverse. For this reason, the ABC, though, struggles to make sense of, say, factions in party politics or power in ethnically diverse suburbs, as revealed by the Wollongong corruption scandal. It's a little bit like making power without glory and saying, have we got an Irishman around? You know, there's none working there. Now, there are ethnically diverse people within the ABC, they're not yet in decision-making positions where it ceases to be an oddity or it's just part of the Australian story. So I'd like to see more Scorsese-style approach to the way power works in this country rather than the token migrant talking about their ethnic group. In terms of class, the auditor identified an underuse of the ABC by lower socioeconomic audiences. The ABC has always been good at exhibiting working class individuals and communities as subjects with problems to be diagnosed or eccentricities to be celebrated, but always they are presented as the other to an assumed middle class audience. I know, I've exhibited them. I did come from Wollongong, and part of me getting into the ABC was that I could speak the lingo, and I had a degree. But I'd like to see programs that emerge from that culture, as you do on the BBC, the harnessing of writers beyond the Bondi, Palm Beach, Balmain triangle. I'd like to see us tap into that energy, which I know to be out there because as a publisher I get damn fine proposals for books, and both in fiction and non-fiction, from that from people who are based in the western suburbs and continue to live there and want to contribute to Australian culture. Now, it's not, no one at the ABC wants to exclude them, we just don't have the mechanisms yet to properly include them. And I used to go on the train out to Campbelltown and try and empower talent, but it was, and we call them talent, but that's not really what I'm on about. I support outsourcing where it's going to give a better result in non-news current affairs areas of ABC television. For the most part, the people that are the independent producers that I know used to work at the ABC. They're the same people. My problem with outsourcing is that it's not sufficiently accountable and not sufficiently transparent. It seems to me the same old keep getting the dough. And I believe that we, if we're going to be serious about it, because majority, as I can see, well over 50% of ABC TV non-news and current affairs is outsourced, then we've got to have transparent criteria and benchmarks. Look, the great thing is if you can do your documentary that way, maybe you can do a contract that gives you more creative power than being at the mercy of, well, the ABC doesn't really make documentaries anymore, but I know what it felt like to have your story recut. And maybe as an outsourced person, you'd fare better. I think there's a bigger problem in drama because the same production companies always seem to get the nod. And my issue there is that they cost a lot. See, I don't accept that we need big budgets to do good drama. If you look at Frontline, if you look at the latest Chris Lilley production, Summer Heights High, they actually use cheaper technology. Those programs cost less and they're more popular and, I would argue, more intelligent and interesting. So the issue is not, sometimes by going lower budget, you can actually make better programs. So I would say, rather than asking for more money for drama, let's get more interesting writers and interesting filmmakers and look at using new technology that's cheaper. I think I'm getting the wind up there. Yep.
Thank you. Many thanks. We'll publish the full paper so Tony can have his full paper published. But we've got to no later than 7 o'clock. I just should say thanks to Mellicent for the use of this fine facility tonight. And I should also mention that we did ask Courtney Gibson from the ABC to come along. She did agree to come and then she had to withdraw. So she's not here, but the other three are. So questions and discussion. Can you just... We're a lot of people here tonight and we don't have a lot of time, so it'd be best if you just give you a question to one particular person. So whilst everyone's warming up, I'll ask Tony, and if we can just keep our answers fairly brief. Tony, in the City Morning Herald last week, you didn't quite get to it tonight, but you suggested changes to the board as a means of bringing about your reforms. But what makes you believe that your changes to the board would have any more impact, although a different kind of impact, than John Howard's appointment to the board, which don't really change much at all? No, Tony, you come up here, and I'll move some chairs. Speak to you.
That article was somewhat cut down from the original version. I am interested in the board being best practice board, and I like the fact that the Nolan rules will depoliticise it in a sense. So the red herring of worrying about who's appointed who and the political bias will be removed. So I support the Rudd government's promise of introducing the Nolan rules, which are hands-off appointment process. I won't go into the detail now. I also support, as well as electing a staff-elected member of the board, having audience-elected members. And I just think that an election for audience reps and perhaps reps from the independent production sector would create interesting debates and enhance a sense of ownership. What I really think will democratise the ABC, though, Jared, which was in the Herald article, is allowing the new digital stations and ABC Online to be a place where the audience can contribute, both commenting on pilots, putting up their own pilots in a YouTube sort of way, very much like the Bulletin was, the Bulletin magazine in the 1890s, not recently, in its heyday, where it scoured the country finding interesting people like Henry Lawson and Norman Lindsay and Banjo Patterson. And I believe this we've now entered an era where it's very possible. It's certainly the way young people like to contribute to the media. It's really a modern version of talkback in a sense, but I actually think we can take it the next... That's already happening. We can take it to the next step where people are participating through that as a portal. And Scott's announced multi-channels allow this because he's announced four, they've got no money, and they're just recycling Margaret and David in the bill at the moment. But the potential is there with proper funding or a licence fee or subscription or... I don't want to get into the financial implications, but for some of these to be, and I don't mean a Wayne's World community access, but a place where there can be a dialogue between different creative Australians. So for me, that's far more important than the board. But the brief for that article was about the board.
So down the back.
Yep.
Yep.
I noticed when an ethical question or a very serious question comes out about a story, about journalism, is it ethical, what the right thing about? Now, very often, a representative of one of the great schools of journalism is on the panel. Now, do you think we should have a great school of journalism? Do you think it's possible at all that we would have one?
With 20 million people, of course we could have a great school of journalism. The 13th largest economy in the world, I'm sure we can afford it. But I guess we'd have to accept that it would have to have certain disciplines, and we'd have to put some effort into developing it. I can't imagine which university would do it, but I guess that's the way around it. I still say, though, that the best way of teaching journalism is at the postgraduate level. I think it's very important that we equip our journalists with a body of knowledge and some analytical tools before we teach them to do monkey tricks, which is essentially what being a journalist is. I mean, I'm a journalist by background, so I'm not saying...
Over there. Yeah.
My question is pretty about the I would like to just gently challenge...
Mm.
I'd like to just gently challenge the first comment you made in your speech. The ABC is left...
Mm.
I find it rather quaint these days.
Mm.
People still use this term, left and right. I think we've grown up beyond those pejorative terms. For instance...
I don't think left is pejorative, is it?
Well, I think it's... Let me go on. Mm.
Well, briefly go
on. One of the definitions of left was private or public ownership. Now we have the Labour side espousing public ownership of this thing, so it's an old thing. So I ask you, when you use the term left, what do you actually mean? And secondly, when you're showing a bias towards some commercialism in the ABC, aren't you espousing 100% bias in that part of the ABC that'll be devoted to commercial programmes?
Okay, that's right. Yeah. But there is a bit of editing
here. Yeah, true. Well, I think a left-wing view, I mean, and as I say, my friends in the Labour government used to say that the ABC was too left-wing for them too. So I'm not talking about Labour liberal, but I think you can identify issues where the ABC would take, say, a fairly predictable line on industrial relations, on economic development, on restrictions necessary for private enterprise and business, on the role of the environmental movement. I think it's a fairly obvious list of concerns that the ABC pursues, and they all have their origins in wishing to challenge or fetter the role of the market. I mean, that's to put it as an economist. Now, what was the other question? What was the second bit?
Well, don't ask questions.
Sorry?
Your wish, as I interpret it.
Oh,
some
I don't have a view about commercialism. I'm just making the point that you can't require that the ABC be entirely government funded, and then expect it to have this enormous budget to do drama and theatre and things like that, which without any tests of accountability, which are usually imposed by fundraising, because you know there's a requirement that you meet performance standards when you raise money. And there is no government-funded broadcasting authority in the world I can think of that is able to fund generous, rich budgets for drama without also going into co-pros and seeking other sources of funding other than taxation.
I just have a very general question. Wasn't it a few years ago that it was suggested to close down the SBS or to amalgamate the SBS with the ABC? Now, I don't really like to see it because both present excellent documentaries. So what's your opinion about that at present? Question to whom it may concern.
Well, I don't think there is a proposal. That was 20 years ago, I think, that the whole government and they dropped it. So anyone want to do it? Especially down the back there, right? Yeah.
There's a question for Tony. It's interesting to hear your comment about ABC, white middle class. As a non-white sort of middle class woman, that's certainly my impression as an audience. I wonder, apart from that, is there any plan to change that white middle class flavor of ABC programming? If so, what is the difference? What would be the difference between ABC and SBS? And by the way, I think SBS is producing some excellent programs.
I don't work at the ABC, so my plans don't amount to anything much, really. But they could talk to the cleaners and accountants at the ABC because there is great ethnic diversity within that milieu. I think they have to look at recruitment, and they actually did have a multicultural unit, but again, that was quite a ham-fisted attempt to do it. So we did stories on migrants. The Aboriginal unit was quite successful in the 80s and 90s and produced some what I would call great art in terms of the aesthetic of the program and really interesting programs. And it wasn't just Aborigines working there, it was a wide cross-section, but it was an outreach to tap people from around the country. And I actually think there needs to be some, not positive discrimination, they need to not, just in the outsourcing, because most of these programs outside News CAF are from outside, and they just need to not go to the same old that they were in the push with back in the 60s or, you know, went to parties with. And we call it the flatmate syndrome in terms of recruitment. But it's most people that are working, come in and move out, seem to be friends of friends. And that can be jumped on. It just takes political leadership. I'd be happy to do it.
Question down there.
You do, Sarsky, and this is a to whom it may concern question. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard that Australian identity and expressing promoting Australian identity is part of the ABC charter. Now, I'm interested in how that's defined, if there's any formal oversight of that by any external body, and furthermore, how that can be improved upon.
Come up to the moment. How do they regard Australian identity down at Deakin University?
Okay. I think one of the points about identity is whose identity, right? And how are you going to interpret it? How are you going to interpret why there's some basic Australian values. We've had this at a government level, the discussion about whether there should be some kind of values which are mandated for anybody entering the country to put their hands up for. I think that perhaps the answer to that is really to look at it as more of a question, as something to be thinking about, not as to be saying this is the identity. It's an Anglo-Celtic one, as has been pointed out before. Half the population and certainly in the major capital cities, half of the population has a parent born abroad. What I see as important with Australian identity is to look at diversity again. This has been the mantra, I think, of the three of us, really, that diversity, diversity and diversity. The BBC has a diversity commissioner. Now, you can have a diversity commissioner who says a certain percentage of gay programs, a certain percentage of whatever programs, whatever sector programs there are, women, etc., etc. But you could also have a diversity program reflecting the diversity of the Australian nation and of views and backgrounds and hopes, wishes, etc. So I think that the issue of values is part of looking at Australian identity, but I think it's the issue of looking at the different kinds of stories that we have, not just one program called Australian Story, looking at various people's trajectories, taking it very proactively as something to try to think about and make programs about from very wide points of view, using producers and directors from those kinds of backgrounds themselves.
Okay, we're getting near the end here, is it?
Alan Grant from McMahon's Point. Don't hear any re-echo. Can you hear me?
They can hear you up, Pitbull, you're okay.
Thank you, Jared.
No. Now, Alan, we've had three speeches tonight, so you just need to look this way and ask a question. I mean, you know, we've had the speeches. So,
I've got more than a question. I've got a finding.
A brief finding.
A very brief finding, which is no one has commented on, the low intellectual, scientific nature of ABC programs.
I think Brugard commented that there was a lack of scientific training among
I commented on catalysts being dumb.
And Tony Moore commented on catalysts being dumb.
I think the problem is that... Very quick.
And if I'd made a comment, I would have said that even the presenter of the gardening program's got a background in the Communist Party, but no one asked me. That's not very scientific.
I think that the ABC needs centres of excellence re-established within staff. They've got to make the decisions about programming, so it can't be outsourced, and they need the top graduates or brains or postgraduates or whoever, but smart people like they have at the BBC and creative filmmakers making these commissioning decisions. And at the moment, I don't think that's the case in the non-news current affairs area of the ABC. And probably in current affairs, they need a policy unit now that Rudd's in government, so that it's not just nothing against insiders, Jared. It's one of my favourite shows. But they need a policy insiders where they've got some people doing some serious grunt, and probably Lateline is the nucleus of a unit that could... because they need to be on top of what Rudd's up to, and I don't think the reporting is good enough at the moment. Certainly wasn't in the 10 years of the Howard government, which is what sent me grey. So I'd love a policy unit in News and Current Affairs, a good science...
A program called policy.
Yeah. And a good science unit in television. The natural history unit got closed down last year, which is shameful. We need intelligent units within the ABC to do this.
I'm losing control of this. Quentin Gibson is even interjecting from the floor. This goes, I call the last question. Okay, John.
more an observation just in response.
Well, not to me,
more an observation just in response. What we've seen since the David Hill era is the comprehensive closing down of specialist units. It was part of the revolution of the postmodern left, in fact. And in fact, that recovery of excellence is what a number of us are pining for, and Robin Williams will endorse that. But under the current regime, under excessive outsourcing, what we're in fact seeing is the collapse of any hope of that. And in the last couple of weeks, we've just seen another round of it. So what we are is dispensing with that very creative middle which gives diversity.
Thank you, John. I think you may have sort of completed it for us. Okay, so look, many thanks. I've been here since 5 o'clock, and it's nearly 7 o'clock. Since half past five, it's nearly 7 o'clock. So I think we've had three great papers today. They'll be good on our pod, and they'll work well when they're published. So, and we've had an interesting discussion period as well. So many thanks to Douglas Kirzner, to Prue Goward, and to Tony Moore for three very perceptive papers from a plurality of views and diversity of opinions, and that's just what we're on about here. So thanks to the three of you tonight, and no doubt we'll have you back in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.